Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio program. And again, we're going to do a special program today associated with the coronavirus, associated with activities that are going on in town, associated with both the City of El Paso Public Health Laboratory and also the University of Texas at El Paso. And I've got two guests today that both are on the front line of what is emerging as to be one of the most important issues. And that's the whole question of testing. Testing to see if we have had the virus or COVID-19, or whether we have not had it and therefore a tendency to be possible candidates to get it pretty soon. So our first guest is Lorraine Torres. She's the director of the Clinical Laboratory Science Program at the University of Texas at El Paso, which has been going on for several years and is in fact trained lots of the people in this general area, within the area. And one of the students that she did mentor and teach many years ago was Ruby Gasca, who is with the City of El Paso Public Health Laboratory in the Medical Center. So Ruby and Lori, welcome both to Science Studio.
Thank you.
I'm going to start with you, Lori, because you've got this wonderful title as director. Tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get into this field very quickly?
It's not a quick answer because I was first a biology major and then went to med school, didn't like it, came back, got a master's in immunology, and then really couldn't find my niche yet. And I went back again to get another bachelor's in medical technology. And now I am an awesome medical laboratory scientist. You're at UTEP. That was too quick. Was that quick enough?
No, that'll do. But tell people, what is a medical technologist?
A medical technologist, or right now that we're known as medical laboratory scientists, are the people who do the actual blood test, the urine test, any test that can be done on a body fluid or tissue. So a lot of times the patient will go to the physician and the physician says, well, I think you have this disease, but not quite sure. Here's your orders, go to the lab. And so then we tell the physician really what's wrong with the patient. So I like to think of clinical laboratory science as the science behind the art of medicine.
Okay, and of course nowadays you cannot see a physician without at some stage being sent off to give blood somewhere or some other fluid. So you're absolutely right. Testing is the key to an awful lot of diagnosis these days.
Yes.
And Ruby, let me just very quickly then come to yourself, Ruby Gasca. You studied in the program that Lori is the director of, correct?
Yes, correct.
How did you choose that area of career goal?
Kind of the same path as Dr. Torres. I wanted to go to medical school, so I was kind of put into the health promotions program, but then I was attending a career fair, and I actually saw Dr. Torres, and, you know, she explained the CLS program, absolutely loved it, and realized that that's back then kind of what I wanted to do. And then I graduated in 2011, and I absolutely love it. Don't regret not going to medical school.
Well, if you'd gone to medical school, you'd just about be finishing by now, right?
Yeah.
About 9, 10 years later.
Yeah.
Okay, so Lori, let's cut to the quick here. When we read and hear that the United States is in the middle of this pandemic, and it does not seem to have reached a peak yet, maybe the curve, as they talk, is flattening, but it's certainly not going the other way, at least only in maybe isolated locations. And people say, well, there's not enough testing. We need more testing, in order to find out what is the situation in North America. When they say testing, what are they testing for? What are the tests?
Well, Ruben can chime in any minute here, but in the beginning, the testing was to actually see if you had the virus itself. In order to do that testing, we needed to check for the viral RNA. Now that there are more information on it, and we can do different kinds of tests, the antibody tests, of which a lot of that is beginning also, but still, so there's two types of testing, an RNA test for the actual virus and an antibody test to see if you have come in contact with the virus in the past.
So the big advantage of the second compared to the first is if you have had the virus and you've recovered, you would not be able to see any RNA of the virus because it's all gone, correct? So that doesn't tell you history.
Right. Well, hopefully. But I believe, Ruby, chime in any time, that the virus, and you can start shedding the virus again. Is that correct, Ruby?
Yeah, that's correct. We're finding, actually, patients that have tested previously positive. 2 weeks later, they come back to be retested, and they're still shedding the virus. So we're getting quite a few positives from the patients that were previously positive, even though they're doing the two-week waiting time and all of that, they're still shedding. You know, this is a novel virus. We're still learning a lot about it. Yeah, that's kind of what we're seeing, the trend. You know, it doesn't happen all the time with all the patients. We do see people that recover and aren't shedding the RNA. But we are seeing that even after the 2 weeks, they're still shedding the virus.
Is that typical of any viral infection? Or is that something special for this particular nasty little bugger?
I think it's special of this nasty little booger. Because normally our immune system, you come in contact with the pathogen, you fight it, you get antibodies, and they're there, and they normally last a while to give you protection. But for some reason, that's not happening in everybody with this virus.
Okay, so there's two tests. Which is the simpler? Which would be the one that if you were in charge, you would simply say, look, we need far, far more testing kits, and we'll come on to what a kit is in a minute. But which of the two, the mRNA or the antibody testing, which do you think is, or are they just a team?
Honestly, I would say we should, you know, stick to the PCR because that's really the only way that we can see whether or not the patient is still shedding the virus. The antibody test will tell us, you know, if, you know, the patient had an infection, but it won't tell us as far as the viral load. I think that's very important. The antibody test, you know, it's good to know to see who's, you know, developed antibodies, especially for the asymptomatic people. I think that's very important. But I think we still need to focus on the RNA testing.
So yeah. You threw out an expression. I know this, but a lot of the audience won't. PCR. Polymerase chain reaction. What do you mean by that, and how does that function, and is that a highly technical type of analytical procedure?
Yes. So it is considered a high complexity test. And so the process is we get nasopharyngeal, oropharyngeal, or a lower respiratory. It could be a tracheal aspirate or a bronchial lavage. And the beginning portion of that is called an extraction, where we basically extract the RNA from the sample. And then that's when we perform the polymerase chain reaction, you know, to see if the patient actually has the COVID-19, the COVID-19 virus.
Very quickly, either of you again, what do you mean by perform the PCR, the polymerase chain reaction? What are we talking about there? What's the process? What are we looking at?
Well, do you want the actual process or basically? Well, okay. Okay, so we're getting the swab, the nasopharyngeal swab that has the virus on it. Then we're going to deactivate the virus and take it apart so that we can get the RNA. And then we're going to amplify that amount of RNA that's there to make it bigger so we can find it. And then we test to see how much RNA is in there compared to controls of this is what it should look like. Mm-hmm. We have positive controls and negative controls to make sure that it's our testing is running correctly. And then we compare, and if it reaches certain levels, then we go like, oh, my gosh, you have the virus. Is that
okay.
simple enough, Ruby?
Yeah.
Or
Yeah, I think so. I think that's pretty good.
Okay.
Yeah. And the point being there that this PCR process is simply, as you pointed out, what we call an amplification, because the dosage that you have in a nasal swab of the actual virus and therefore the RNA is going to be so small that we can't analyze it. So
Correct.
We have this trick, if you like, of taking a little bit and making it regurgitate itself rapidly into amounts that we can readily detect. All right?
Yes, that's yes. correct.
So now, are there any problems associated with the tests? Let's go to the first one. How expensive are they? How reliable are they? So let's go either way. Is this an expensive process?
It could be. So the Department of Public Health Laboratory is, we actually have a grant from the Laboratory Response Network. The LRN was created by the CDC actually just for this, to be able to prepare for anything from bioterroristic events to emerging diseases. And so that's how we were able to rapidly prepare for COVID-19. So we actually get our testing primers and probes, or test kits, like everyone knows them as, from the CDC. That's
so
for the
PCR. So they all come from one single source. So this is not something where if I went to a shop where they have kits, I could get kits made all over the place. These all come from the CDC?
So the ones that we have here, yes. The initial tests that came out back in January, yes, they were exclusively from the CDC. Now there are a lot of companies like Abbott, Hologic, that have created their own PCR test.
So, Ruby, you point out that now there are all sorts of people making these tests. Is it the same test that is just being manufactured, or are there slight variations in process and in content?
Yes, so it is basic principle is the same PCR, but there are variations out there as far as what they're looking for. But yes, it's, you know, pretty much the same principle. It's to detect COVID-19.
And they have to be approved by the CDC before anybody could use them?
They actually have to get approved by the FDA. And so they're issued an emergency use authorization, EUA, before they're able to put their test on the market.
Okay. And one of the things that you read, in fact, just in preparation for talking to you ladies, I went to the internet and found studies from a consortium of universities in California, Berkeley, San Francisco, that quite often in a lot of these newer tests, or let me put it another way, not newer, but private company tests, the satisfactory result isn't always obtained. That is, reliability can be up to 9-10% giving false positives. That could be a problem. How do you go about doing that in your own studies here or your own investigations? How do you check that you're not getting a false positive, for example? Is that simple?
Do you want to answer this? Or
well, yeah. You can talk about the controls. Yeah, the controls that we use in
okay.
the testing. Yeah.
Yeah, so in any clinical laboratory setting, it's a standard when you're going to bring on a new test, you have to perform what we call validation studies. So we basically, you know, review the product, you know, check for the sensitivity and specificity, which is what they're talking about when it comes to reliability, and then we perform our own test. So we basically run, we can run controls, or we can run actual patient samples that we have known values for, and kind of compare when the laboratory runs a test to what the results should actually be. And then from there, we can determine whether or not this is a reliable enough test. We also have to pay attention to, you know, the process, if there was something that the analyst did wrong, or if there, you know, was some sort of contamination that was causing either a false positive or a false negative. So it's very detailed. It's not, you know, as simple as, okay, we picked up this test and let's get going. There's a lot of thought and analysis that has to go through before you even implement a test into the laboratory.
Yes, that's excellent, right? Because you're working for a government agency, right? City of El Paso.
Correct.
But if I were to simply wander into, if I could, a doctor's office, tell them to swab my nose and send it off to some commercial place, do they have to have the same background of standard testing and all of the reproducibility aspects of the analysis that you do?
Yes, it is all the same throughout the clinical laboratory community. There are accrediting agencies such as CLIA and CAP that are there to guarantee that the laboratories are performing the test as they should be, and that they're complying with the regulations.
So then when I read that research groups at California, Berkeley, San Francisco, et cetera, are looking and finding false positives of, let's say, 10%, what does that mean? Is it that they're not looking at it the right way because they don't understand the actual real-world analytical system? Or what am I missing here?
Well, let me jump in a little bit. So research is different from the clinical. We definitely need the researchers out there doing their investigations so that we are in the clinical side can do the testing correctly. Now, false positives can be even just the fact of how they did the testing. Maybe their well number one, for example, was so positive that some of it carried over into well number two. So it all depends on their technique. There are lots of other situations, but when you're doing the clinical side, we have processes that we look at pre-analytical, analytical, and post-analytical errors that could possibly be doing. So before we even release a result, we have to check everything. Pre-analytical, did we even follow the direct line that the sample has to go through? Was the sample taken correctly? So on the clinical side, we look at all that to try to decrease those false positives as much as we can.
I was going to interrupt you and rudely, but I often do. And that is, you're talking about these wells. So this is, from my point of view, a piece of glass or a piece of plastic material with little depressions, right? I don't know how many you do, 68, 120, who knows? But each one, you have this very small amount of material that you're pipetting into to do the subsequent tests. And what you're saying is that in that process of deposition of the sample in these tiny little depressions, they're not wells, they're just depressions on a surface, that's where you can often get mixed contamination?
Yes. Ruby, you want to chime in? Is that anything else?
Dr. Torres was mentioning, it could be, you know, technique, because there are, it is minute amounts that we're using. For example, we use about 5 microliters of patient sample to do the test, and that's enough to do the amplification and see if they have COVID-19. But it could be something as simple as, you know, a flick of a wrist and, you know, a tiny droplet went to the other well, or we use a seal on top of our plate.
I'm smiling at this because at the moment I'm undergoing all sorts of eye drops for a condition in my eyes, and you know, it seems simple enough, right?
Yeah.
Stopper, open your eye, look up, fucking it goes. I'd say about 30% of the time I get some on my eyelashes, my eyelids. I mean, it's a mess.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
This brings up to the point then of the people who are doing this, how big of a staff down here in the City of El Paso Public Health Laboratories do you have doing this right now? Because it must be, well, you do all day long, all night long. Now you've got Laurie helping out at night.
So initially with the Laboratory Response Network team, we have three people. And actually at the beginning of COVID-19, we were ready to go. And then it came down to just one person, myself, for a couple of weeks. But we have a very good team here. Everyone was ready to jump in and help. So we have, I want to say, a good 10 people at any given day that can help with the testing, plus the help of UTEP with Dr. Torres, Dr. Dominguez, Ms. Camacho, and Ms. Almeida, who are excellent, by the way. And our turnaround times for the results are less than 24 hours.
How many tests are you doing, though? I mean, one reads that we need 1 million a day or 2 million a day all over the whole country. And that just seems to me an incredible amount of manpower and concentration, because your point is so well taken. I'm a laboratory performer myself in chemistry. And it's something that's not particularly critical, life and death, which you are doing is, I take it very simply. And I won't find out for 2 days. Oh, damn it, I forgot this reagent. Well, that's not true. I didn't put enough or something like that. How do you cope with that? But the intensity.
Most of the staff here were, trained. This is exactly what we went to school for with clinical laboratory sciences, to be able to handle these situations through the guidance, of course, of Dr. Torres and everyone else. This is what we studied, and everyone is fully aware at all times that it is life or death, that everyone's relying on us for those results. But everyone is very professional, and we love what we do. And I think that also has to do with our performance here.
Go back to the question I did ask. Approximately how many tests do you do a day for the whole facility? And is it a day-night, two-shift system or what?
No. So at the moment, we haven't had to switch to two shifts. We're still running Sunday through Saturday from 7 to 6. And it just really varies as far as our sample load. Initially, we were doing the testing for all of El Paso, but there are now 5 hospitals that have been able to bring the test on board themselves. So our volume has, dropped. We're also helping out with the mobile testing sites. With patients that are under investigation still, and that's the bulk of our workload. On a given day, we could do anywhere between 40 to 50. Our busiest day, we had about 89 samples that were tested.
So if I multiply that by these other sites, 4 or 5, maybe we're getting up to, let's say, 200 to 400 a day tests?
Easy, I would say yes.
Yes, and as professionals, Laurie and Ruby, what would you say we need in order to be able to be comfortable with the decision to slowly reopen businesses? I mean, I'm not going to go to a restaurant in a hurry, I will tell you that. First of all, I've got some underlying conditions. I've got a few years under my belt. But even if I didn't, I'd be very careful. What would you think for a city of El Paso size, 800,000 people, how many tests a day do we need to be doing to be able to make good decisions into the future about how we go about our business?
Well, I think that's a complicated question, because the testing that's being done now are on individuals that either are suspected of having COVID or have come in contact with someone. Mm-hmm. In order to answer your question, I think that we would have to do, almost the entire city to see actually how many have it. So we're
right.
just testing the people that are positive. We don't know how many people. We don't know how many people have actually come in contact, and they may have had it and didn't even know it. And so that's information that's where our researchers need to come in. I don't know. What do you think, Ruby?
No, I completely agree. It's going to be a joint effort between the laboratories, epidemiology, research to be able to properly answer that question. And then, of course, everyone practicing social distancing, that's a big thing that's going to really help.
Yeah, I can see all that, but I'm a little lost at the moment. What would the researcher in a laboratory do to answer the question is how much testing do we want? Epidemiologists, I can see. But if I've got a biochemical laboratory or biological laboratory, what sort of questions would you ask that would make the answer to that initial question, how much testing do we need, more apparent?
Okay, so again, I'm kind of stuck in between a researcher and clinical. I'm more of a clinical person, but I think we would actually need people to volunteer and just say, okay, take a sample from me and then just see how many actual people are here. Like, let's go. Well, we can't go to a mall anymore. Let's just go somewhere and ask people to come volunteer and do this. The only thing is, as a researcher, we cannot give results back to the patient. So this is just an epidemiological type study to actually see how many people have actually come in contact or have had it.
Okay.
Based on that number, then you can say, oh my gosh, almost everybody's got it. Just open up. Or no. There's so many people that still haven't come in contact with it. We need to keep it down so that our hospitals aren't overloaded. Things like that. But again, people aren't going to want to volunteer without having a result given back. And that's the big thing. In order to give patient results back, there's a process that you have to go through, like physicians and licensing, et cetera. So that's when, again, I think it has to be done on just basically a research side. Let's just test. How many are actually out there from a contact?
Okay.
And that's my side. I don't know. What do you think, Ruby?
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's why we also, at the collection sites, we do have a questionnaire to see, if the person came in contact with anyone who had tested positive for COVID-19 or was symptomatic. Those questions are very important to be able to perform these studies and kind of determine, just like Dr. Torres said, if everyone has it, or if it is, just through contact, what trends we're seeing here in El Paso, or, the United States or even the world, to see when would be a good time to open.
The people that work down there with these fluids and doing the PCR and doing all the testing, do you get tested on a daily basis yourselves, or a weekly basis, or how does that work? Because you're working with the fluids, and I would think that would be a concern.
Yes, and it was something that was addressed immediately when we were told, okay, COVID-19, we have to start preparing for this. As biosafety officer, it was my job to be able to prepare guidelines to be able to protect the staff for testing. And, at the beginning of January, we knew absolutely nothing about the novel coronavirus. So the guidelines that we received from the CDC were to prepare just as they did with SARS, using, we could use a BSL-2, biosafety level 2 facility, but using biosafety level 3 precautions. So we, from the very beginning, sent guidelines to the hospitals. As soon as you receive a sample, decontaminate it. Decontaminate the biohazard bags. Make sure that they're double bagged. When the courier picks them up, make sure that you're decontaminating the cooler. When we receive them here, we decontaminate the coolers, the bags. We do not open any samples unless we have them under a biosafety cabinet, and everyone is fully geared up with an N95 mask and a lab coat or a gown. We keep the door closed, and we do have signs outside that say, you know, COVID-19 testing in progress. And so that's the guidance that we've implemented here to be able to protect everyone. We're constantly decontaminating the entire laboratory 2, 3, 4 times a day, from the very entrance of the laboratory to our computer stations and our phones. We do monitor daily when we come in for temperatures, any signs and symptoms. We've been self-monitoring since this whole process began. But we do not actually test ourselves. That is something that we're looking into to see if there are the resources to be able to test the employees here, because our main priority is a community. So we need to preserve our resources to be able to test everyone else. So we just kind of self-monitor. That's the process that we're doing right now.
Which is, I suppose, what the majority of us out in the real world are doing too. But that's, it seems to me that people on the front line, and we've got family members on the front line up in Boston, and, you know, they don't get tested. And I feel for you, Ruby, and for you, Laurie. I mean, you're in there every day. And so, Laurie, let's just finish the program. Your role here is just purely as a volunteer from the laboratory that trained a lot of the people who are down there in the City of El Paso laboratory, but you're just volunteering your time to give extra manpower and a certain amount of release time. Another faculty from UTEP also. Who are the other faculty? Just let's name them.
Yes, that's Dr. John Mole from biology. And I'm sorry, Ruby, I forget Miguel's last name.
I actually forgot too. I feel so horrible.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you, Miguel.
Thank you, Miguel.
Yeah, he's a PhD student.
Yeah.
So, but he's absolutely amazing. I'm sorry, Miguel.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Miguel. Yeah, Miguel from biology also. So Miguel, awesome Miguel, and awesome John Mole from biology. Yes.
So, by volunteering, though, they have to have passed a certain level of training and be certified to be able to be there. I mean, I couldn't volunteer. I would be a bull in a china shop. So these other people that are volunteering, like yourself, Laurie, are really professionals that happen not to work down there during the day.
Yes, they're professionals. They know the process. They know the extent now. And it's funny, speaking with Miguel, he says, oh, my gosh, I've never really seen the clinical side. This is totally amazing. And so he understands both sides now, clinical and research. But Miguel is good.
Okay.
We do have strict guidelines as far as who can test. So it's the process of observing, then performing the tests themselves, and then we kind of put them through a test to make sure that they do everything properly before we check them off to be able to do the testing on their own.
Okay. Ladies, it's been a delight listening to the two of you interact. You almost sound like one from time to time. And so Ruben Gasca down there in the City of El Paso, health laboratory down there in the medical center near UMC. Thank you for what you're doing. Thank you for being so articulate and easy to understand when you discuss what is really a very complex system. And Laurie, thank you, professor, director of the Clinical Laboratory Science Program at UT El Paso. You're volunteering. And just one quick question. When do you cease to volunteer? When your services are no longer needed?
When Ruby says, okay, we don't need you anymore.
All right. That may be a long time.
Could be. I don't know.
I would keep her forever if I could.
Okay. Well,
and Elizabeth Camacho also. So
yeah,
to make sure Elizabeth, Elizabeth actually puts more time in there than I do. So thank you, Elizabeth.
Ladies, thank you so much, both of you, Ruby and Laurie. Ruby with a Y, Laurie with an I. And it's been a great pleasure and an honor, actually, to recognize you and let the city and the people who listen to Science Studio know what's going on and feel a little bit safer for it, I think. Thank you so much, both of you.
Thank you.
And I'd like to thank Sam Cassiano that makes a lot of sense out of this at the end, so it sounds seamless to you. And we'll be back next week with another Science Studio, highlighting some other people from UT El Paso doing something along the lines of trying to understand this novel coronavirus and the COVID-19 disease it creates. We'll see you then. Take care. Bye-bye.